This is the Meiji at 150 podcast. I'm Tristan Gruno. On this episode, I'm talking with Sherry Kajiwada, director-curator of the Nikkei National Museum at the Nikkei Center in Burnaby. She recently edited The Tree Trunk Can Be My Pillow, the biography of an outstanding Canadian about Eikichi Kagetsu, published by the University of Victoria Press in 2017. Sherry, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Today you're going to be talking about the history of Japanese Canadians, which I understand dates back to the Meiji period, and particularly the year 1877. Can you give us a quick overview of that history of Japanese immigration to Canada?
So the official record, the community record, what you'll see on Wikipedia and in history books, states that Manzo Nagano arrived in 1877. There is some debate about that. But in 1977, there was a celebratory year for the Japanese Canadian community, and they marked it as the 100th anniversary of Japanese immigration to Canada, hinging that number around what they could find about Manzo Nagano. So, yes, 1877. There is definitely evidence of Japanese fishermen or travelers coming. When I say travelers, everything was by ship. So people traveling here by ship far before that. And if we were to get into older history, I'm sure there would be other stories. There are probably oral histories, and an area that my museum is interested in investigating at some future date are the intersections between the Japanese migration and the First Nations, the indigenous people here, because we are convinced that there is evidence of the intersection of the two communities, and that predates that. However, yes, the official immigration timeline begins at 1877 with Manzo Nagano splashing down literally in New Westminster, which was then the downtown of Vancouver. So around that time, you know, it was a time in Japan when life wasn't so great for individuals who were not necessarily the eldest son. But this could be said about much of the globe in terms of the pioneering spirit that was happening around that time. But in particular from Japan, Canada was seen as a land of opportunity, or more correctly, and even until recently, I think a lot of Japanese consider this sometimes America. And they're not wrong. It's called the Americas, I guess, in North America. But the attraction, the promise of riches, of opportunity, I'm sure was a big draw, as it was for many of the immigrants who came.
So what do we know about Manzo Nagano before he came to Canada and then afterwards?
He tried his hand in a few different enterprises. Fishing was definitely one of them. But the settling in Canada actually happened in Victoria, where he had a boarding house as well as a retail shop. He became quite established in Victoria, actually, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He did end up returning to Japan and dying there. But in his memory, or to commemorate his legacy, there is a mountain in BC named after him. So he was just a young man who came looking for opportunity. Fishing was a logical area to be involved in. That just was often the reason that individuals came over initially, but then very soon found his way into the urban structure of Victoria.
And I understand many of the Japanese immigrants came from the same area in Mie Prefecture.
Mie Prefecture was a huge draw. And there's seminal work done by Dr. Audrey Kobayashi, presently of Queens, for her original PhD work. She did incredible study of the movement of Japanese from primarily Shigaken, to the west coast of Canada. And it's interesting to note that that's not the only area of migration, but that was definitely one of the largest. And one of the largest where there was movement, she was able to track the movement not only to Canada, but through the war years, through internment, and actually even some movement back. There's an interesting tidbit, a little fact about her research. Mio apparently produced the largest number of baseball players who became the famous Vancouver Asahi. Many, many, many members of that team originated from Mio.
And you mentioned that Manzo Nagano initially landed in New Westminster and then later went to Victoria. I understand many immigrants came to Steveston, and there was a large community down there.
Yes, and actually from New Westminster, obviously the logical first stop would be Steveston, just at the mouth of the Fraser River, and again, for the fishing industry. But there were definitely other industries that attracted immigrants, logging, timber. There was definitely a strong mining industry happening here. Resource rich, definitely.
And so at its peak, do we have any numbers or figures of how large the Japanese Canadian population was prior to 1942?
So 1901 is the first year that the Japanese government documented Japanese population in BC. And at that time, the Canadian population was 5 million. There were 178,657 residents in BC, of which 4,738 were Japanese. It increased 190% by 1911, another 176% by 1921, 147% by 1931, and then you see a drastic decrease. There was still an increase. Now we're talking population increase, so that's not just migration, but in 1941, that dropped to 99%. So in 1941, Canada had a population of 11.5, and BC residents were just upwards of 800,000, and there were 23,149 Japanese documented in Canada, just to give you the range of stats. It's interesting also to compare that to the American migration, because Japanese were in the United States much longer, and their numbers were much larger, but proportionately, the per capita residency in BC, when you take it out of the total population of Japanese migration to Canada, was arguably much, much higher percentage-wise.
You mentioned that at first, many of the immigrants who came to Canada were male, presumably looking for work. Then do their families come later? Do they start families? Or what's the family life here?
Good question. BC was extremely racist at the time, and there were a lot of restrictions on Asian migration in general. So for the South Asian population and the Chinese population in particular, there were already serious immigration restrictions, which were basically just as a blanket policy applied to the Japanese. But if you remember, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And in fact, the first Japanese consulate in Vancouver opened in 1889. So not long after, you know, we have Manzo Nagano arriving. And at that time, Japan was allied with England, with Britain. And the UK, of course, was the governing body of Canada. So everyone in Canada was considered a British subject. So because of that alliance there, and because of the presence of a consulate in Vancouver, and interesting that comment about Victoria, you would think the consulate would have been in Victoria at the time. And they originally were going to. There is actually documentation in the Japanese government records that Victoria was originally identified and then crossed out and renoted by hand Vancouver. And that was, again, part of the consular research that was done in 2013, 2014. And interestingly enough, because of that presence and because of the Japanese government in Canada and because of the friendship between Japan and England, there were some protections for the Japanese migrants. And in particular, a very powerful protective move was there was the Chinese head tax that was levied on Chinese male immigrants who were basically indentured labor brought to Canada to work on the railway and infrastructure of the country. And at one point, that was almost $500 per head. And we're talking, when you think about the time, that was definitely onerous. The BC government wanted to make it an Asian head tax and apply it to the Japanese population, but the consul at the time, in defense of his people and also in recognition of this alliance, really lobbied with the powers that be to not have that happen, and he was successful. So the migration for Japanese was a little bit more fluid. And again, initially it was men because they were coming in search of opportunity and jobs and things like that. But in 1907, there were the anti-Asian sentiments did not stop in the late 1800s and really escalated. And in 1907, there are the famous anti-Asian race riots that happened in Vancouver. In 1908, largely in response to that, there are further negotiations between the Japanese and the British government, and there was a gentleman's agreement struck in the United States, and similarly, there is the Hayashi-Lemieux gentleman's agreement that was negotiated for Vancouver. And with that, the immigration from Japan to Canada was capped at 400, but included women and children, included families, which the other Asian migration policies did not. So that ushered in an era of the picture bride. And between 1908 and 1928, I believe, I don't have my speaking notes for this afternoon at my ready, but I believe that's correct, because in 28, the numbers were reduced because of, again, rising racism and the imminent threat of war. And again, with the Second World War, of course, Japan was on the other side and not allied. So with that, the immigration numbers were reduced further to 150. And something else happened. In 1931, so a few years later, there was an order in council that precluded naturalization status if you retained a previous country's citizenship, and Japan did not have you could not renounce your citizenship actually at that time. So it basically made it impossible for naturalized Japanese immigrants to get Canadian papers. So there's a lot of interesting politics involved with, obviously, economical pressures and this just environment of racism that existed then.
Riots. Can you give us a bit more detail on the background of those and then also the ramifications?
The original background was, again, interestingly enough, how influenced we are by our American cousins. It was actually instigated by race riots that happened south of the border. And it was really a white supremacist, for lack of a better word, attempt to erase the Asian peril. And it was about jobs. It was economic. It was thought and felt at the time, just according to all the evidence that I've been able to see, that Asians were harder working, willing to work for less pay, and were very successful. You know, the Japanese in Canada, right from the beginning, they were entrepreneurial, they were pioneering, they were ambitious, and I'm generalizing, but that was very true across the community in all the different industries and all the different walks of life. And there was definitely anger and possessiveness and a feeling of we need you out. So what started as a labor riot, actually, a movement, a very misguided movement that felt that if there was this physical act of activism, that the powers that be or the government of the day would eject the threat, the menace. So that's how it started. But it started as a labor riot, and basically the buzzword was to create a white Canada at the steps of the then City Hall in Vancouver. And it traveled to Chinatown first, and that's where the famous photos of the broken glass and the damage and the violence that have been recorded. Mm-hmm. In fact, UBC has an excellent collection of those heritage photographs. The worst damage was in Chinatown, and then from there they were making their way up to Powell Street, Paodugai, or Powell Grounds, which euphemistically is called Japantown, but was never named that at the time. And so our community had more warning, but they were also more organized to protect themselves. So it was really quite quickly diffused, and there was relatively little damage to the Japanese downtown center at the time.
You mentioned the photographs that we have here at UBC in the Japanese Canadian Photograph Collection, including, I think we have 23 exactly of photographs that were damaged of Japanese-owned buildings. And so this one I've always found very striking. I've seen it. It seems to be... It's a very famous photograph.
It is a very famous photograph.
I saw it at the Vancouver Maritime Museum. We used it in your poster. But two things I always found very striking about the photograph is the woman in the door seems to be smiling, which was...
And holding a child.
And holding a child, which was funny. But then on the far right, there is a man wearing a turban.
That's right.
And so you mentioned that there was this strong tie between the Japanese community in the Lower Mainland and also the South Asian community.
Yes.
And obviously it dates back very early. What do we know about those relationships?
Well, it's not a well investigated relationship, but we do know they existed, particularly in the lumber industry, in the logging industry. And the South Asians were actually quite successful, the Royston logging camp on the island, for example. And they would have been potential employers who would hire Japanese workers. There were also... Conversely, there were very established, by the time World War II happened, very established logging camps owned by Japanese and Japanese Canadians who conversely would hire others, shall we say, because, and again, it was partly out of necessity, partly out of trying to find some success in a country that didn't want you. The South Asian population, as you know, there's the tragedy of the Komagata Maru. Mm. Oh, and if you don't, you must look that up because it's very heavily researched. There were some celebrations in recent years, and there's a fantastic website, Komagata Maru. It's the name of the ship that traveled here. That was actually they were seeking safe harbor. They were basically refugees and trying to escape tyranny, and they were refused and sent back, and many of them did end up being killed. I'm actually, you know, what I haven't done is found out exactly where this is.
According to the description that we have, it's 130 Powell Street.
Oh, thank you. Well, then that is Powell Grounds, and that is the main Powell Street was, of course, the main retail corridor. And that's the other thing. The reason that area, euphemistically known as Japantown, was even created was really in response to the racist environment. And that's also why Chinatown existed. You know, it was areas, from one point of view, they could be criticized as ghettoizing the communities. But on the other side, they were safe havens where the constituents could speak their own language. They could enjoy their own foods, they could share their cultures, and there was a fairly free flow between all of the Asian populations at that time. And because Powell Street would have been more family-oriented, it was very much thriving, and it was definitely a very prospering part of the city, although it was considered the first stop for migrants or immigrants from Japan. And once you established yourself, you actually moved out. You moved further afield. And by 1942, there were very established enclaves in Marpole, in Fairview, in like all around what we would now call Olympic Village, Granville Island, right up into the Broadway Canby, Main Street area. There was a large population in Kitsilano and a very affluent population in Shaughnessy and even into North and West Vancouver. We're just talking the spread from immediate Vancouver, notwithstanding that there were definitely farms in the valley and, you know, if we move further out. But the entire community, regardless of how far they were spread out from the downtown core, would come into town, and that would be the downtown area. Mm-hmm. So it would also have been popular for any other communities who were perhaps restricted or barred from Canadian, Caucasian
And I imagine
places.
With all the kind of structural racism that you were talking about earlier, it's not too easy for people to move out of Japantown, right? I mean, other kinds of redlining policies or landlords who are reluctant to lend to non-white people, for example.
In the early days, but as I was explaining, the Japanese came and prospered. They were the landlords. They were the... There's a really interesting longhouse that was built by a Japanese immigrant, and it's part of a new Fairview Mountain, Mount Pleasant, walking tour that we are developing, and it exists today. It was so well built, and the original gentleman who built it was a shipbuilder. You know, talk about the fishing influence and all of that. And it is still there today, and it is now an apartment. It's a multi-purpose, multi-resident living building that we have identified, and actually Heritage BC is interested in perhaps designating it as a significant stop in Vancouver. That's not to confuse with the heritage sites of significance, which is something else entirely. But there is a local heritage recognition of local. The city of Vancouver. There's walking tours and things like that. So this is our own museum map. But we have discovered that this tenement house, this longhouse, was built then for Japanese workers and families, and is still standing today.
Out of my own curiosity, this figure, the South Asian man in this photograph, it always makes me wonder, because now we think of most of the South Asian community in Vancouver lives in Surrey. So at this time, would Japantown, Chinatown, would there have been a South Asia town in the same area?
That I don't know about, but I do know that the mills were there, right in the harbor. Right along Alexander Street, Hastings Mill was the largest employer of all immigrant workers. So they were most likely in the neighborhood for work, and then probably on Powell Street for lunch or, you know, groceries or things like that. And of course, that is the famous anti-Asian race riot day. So there was probably many Asians who were trying to help defend each other, and I would hope.
Street. And so were there community events? Now we have the Powell Street Matsuri.
Right.
And how far back does that date?
Well, the Powell Street Festival actually started, I believe it started in 1977. It was the return, right? It was really it did not exist as we know it now. But what did exist was the Vancouver Asahi baseball team in Oppenheimer Park. And Oppenheimer Park is the ground where Powell Street Festival happens annually. And it really, Powell Street Festival, the modern Powell Street Festival, is really a reclaiming of that neighborhood, even if only for 48 hours. And there is a commemorative baseball game that gets played right in that park a week or two later. But it was an active baseball field, and it was the team was very successful, and they were really a bridge over racism, and in fact became so popular with the mainstream Canadian audience that you know, they would fill the stands. And so it wasn't a festival per se, but there were regular gatherings of community. And it was interesting that the sport of baseball even continued on into the internment camps as a friendship. I shouldn't say friendship. It was really what broke down barriers. Baseball helped break down barriers. It crossed over racism and feelings of alienation and really helped bring people together then, and I believe continues to now.
Can you tell us more about the baseball team? Were they in the local, like, minor leagues or anything
they
like that?
They were. So, and their history is long. Like, it starts in the 20s. And there's a fantastic series of books written by Mrs. Pat Adachi. And there are some movies that have been made. There's actually a really famous contemporary Japanese movie that was made with a couple of pop stars a few years ago on the Vancouver Asahi that give a more fictionalized, Hollywoodized, I guess, version of the story. But in the early days, the early time period, the Japanese players were not able to compete very well with their Canadian counterparts because they were so much physically smaller. And it was just brute force and strength that the Canadian Caucasian teams were able to overpower the Canadian Japanese team. But there is a pivotal moment, and I'm sorry, I don't have the exact date at my fingertips, but if you check Sleeping Tigers or any of Pat's books on the Asahi. There's also actually a recent book that was penned in Japan by an author with the last name of Goto about the Asahi. It's written in Japanese and it has recently, interestingly enough, been translated into English. And we have both versions in our museum shop that gives a really interesting overview, and he talks about this moment. But actually, I highly recommend that book to your listeners and the students of the Japanese history here because it also gives the overview. It puts this baseball team within the context of Japanese migration and the early history. But there was this pivotal moment where bunting, because the Japanese players were fast. They were small, but they were smart and they were fast. And they were smart, which was why it was called brain ball. It was actually publicized in the newspapers of the day as the team wins again with brain ball. And that actually was the pivotal moment that changed the game for everyone. And it really, it brought them into the equivalent of the major leagues. They are now, the Vancouver Asahi, the historical Vancouver Asahi are now in the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame, the National Sports Hall of Fame, and the local BC Sports Hall of Fame. So it's quite a wonderful story.
Growing up in the United States, especially on the West Coast, I learned a lot about the Japanese-American internment. But since I've moved up to British Columbia, I'm hearing more about this, and I've started to notice a lot of cases where the Canadian case was actually much longer and actually much different than
it was much harsher. It was much harsher. The significant difference is Japanese immigration into the United States had been happening for a lot longer, so the population was much more established, and the United States had a constitution. There were civil rights in place for the people of the nation. In Canada, even though numerically we were smaller, but the entire population of Canada was smaller. You could take off a zero, you know, everywhere. And, but the, again, I was saying at the opening of this talk that we had a much larger proportion of immigration here. It was much harsher because we did not have the protection of a constitution. There was, it almost feels like the racist policies, the economic threat was somehow amplified in Canada, magnified out of proportion. So when Pearl Harbor happened, which was the defining moment for all of our shared histories, the war really gave the excuse, gave the opportunity, gave the reason to once and for all eradicate Canada of the... They couldn't eradicate the entire Asian menace, but they could try to eradicate the Japanese. It was the equivalent of ethnic cleansing up here. So the there were orders in council. I'll talk about it more this afternoon. But there were. Let me see if I can just give you a quick rundown of the sequence of events that happened in early 1942. So of course Pearl Harbor happens in December 1941. December 7th, to be exact. January 8, 9 of 1942, there's a conference in Ottawa called the Japanese Problem, where they're deciding what to do. And in January 14, so very shortly after that, there is a declaration of Japanese males as enemy aliens. But quite frankly, the way the government behaved from that point on, they were treating the entire population of as enemy aliens, regardless of where you were born. And it was all under the auspices of the War Measures Act. And we were at war. The country was at war. So that's then in February 19, the Order in Council PC-1486 defines a 100-mile exclusion zone all along the coast of BC. And this is what enables the forced uprooting, the forced dispersal of over 22,000 people of Japanese ancestry in Canada from the West Coast.
And then how long did that last?
So the war ends in 1945. In the United States, American Japanese are allowed back home.
Right.
In Canada, there is a loyalty survey that, or the threat actually of a loyalty survey, because interestingly enough, the Americans had a loyalty survey that was given very early on. And our loyalty survey was circulated throughout all the internment camps and to all the areas where the Japanese Canadians and Japanese were being detained. And basically, it wasn't a survey. It was the threat of one, because it said that you, although the war is over, these are not the exact words, but in essence, what it said was the war is over. However, to show if you are loyal to Canada, you will move further east of the Rockies. This is 1946.
46.
If you choose to not do that, then you are deemed disloyal and you will be sent to Japan. Actually, they said you will return home to Japan. Ironically, of the 4,000 who were deported, 2,000 were born in Canada. So how do you return to somewhere you've never been? And life was really hard for those who did take that option. Many took it under duress. The government really sugarcoated it, though. They paid their way. They made it fully financially lucrative, or not lucrative, but attractive. And if you were loyal and you chose to go east, you were on your own. You had no support. So that was the main difference. But furthermore, the Canadian government was able to continue the essence of the War Measures Act. The War Measures Act was ineffectual after the war ended, but there was other policies in place that kept it going that had to be renewed annually. And the local government, the Canadian government, did renew it annually until 1948. And in 1948, 1949, Canada was trying to join the United Nations on a, there was a global initiative at the time, which really involved peacemaking. And they could not, in good conscience, be a part of that while they were detaining their own citizens, or treating their own citizens as enemy aliens. Because according to the Geneva Convention, anyone born in your country cannot be labeled an enemy alien, and you cannot intern them. You can only intern enemy aliens. So that's why I'm saying the government, although they didn't officially label them other than this one notice about Japanese men, they just certainly treated the population, women and children, everyone, because they did intern them, regardless of where they were born, and deported them, regardless of where they were born. So the Japanese population in Canada was not allowed to return to the West Coast until 1949, which is also the same year that they were finally given the franchise, the right to vote. And that is definitely 4 years longer than in the United States.
The Meiji at 150 podcast is hosted by Tristan Gruno at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. This podcast would not be possible without the cooperation of the UBC Center for Japanese Research and the technical assistance of the UBC Faculty of Arts ISIT. Find out more about the Meiji at 150 project, including the Meiji at 150 lecture series, digital teaching resource, and workshop series by visiting our website, meijiat150.arts.ubc.ca. Thank you for listening.